This is Radio Boston. I'm Adam Ragusea in for Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. A little earlier this hour, we talked about how to get your kids riled up and moving by roughhousing, safely, of course, with them. But what about when you want some quiet time? You might try settling them into the serenity and grace found in one of the most famous children's books of all time, E.B. White's Charlotte's Web.
Now, what was White's inspiration for that story of a spider and a pig? Well, it turns out it was time that he spent on a farm in Maine, where, in White's own words, this boy felt for animals a kinship he never felt for people.
Michael Sims writes about White's life in Maine in the new book, The Story of Charlotte's Web, E.B. White's eccentric life in nature and the birth of an American classic. And as Sims writes, that birth dates back to when E.B. White, also known as Andy, had his first significant encounter with a barn spider.
The spider lived on the underside of the barn's roof. Sheltered from the elements by an overhang, her web was an elegant orb whose loops and strands glittered on dewy mornings like an antique necklace. Every night she made the rounds of her miniature cosmos, tightly wrapping prey, cutting loose and jettisoning debris, reweaving broken strands. That busy autumn of 1948, as Andy went in and out of the shed during the endless daily routine of farm chores, he kept an admiring eye on the work of the tiny creature who lived her equally conscientious life above his head. He had been observing her for several days, watching the dew glitter in the mornings and the web almost disappear as the moisture evaporated by midday, glimpsing the spider herself as she emerged in the twilight to begin the night shift. In the evening, he stood below her web and peered up at it, watching his gumdrop-sized neighbor scurry toward prey or hang upside down in the center of the web, patiently waiting.
And Michael Sims, the fascination, it doesn't end there. What happened next?
Oh, it's a wonderful story. He discovers one night that she is creating something in the web. He realizes it's an egg sac, a round, lightweight object. And he watches her lay eggs in it, and then he doesn't see her again. And so several days later, he winds up thinking, well, I've got to see how this story turns out. And he climbs up and cuts the egg sac down with a razor blade in the exact way that Templeton will do this in the book later. And he takes it with him, puts it in his pocket, and takes it off to his apartment in New York, punches some holes in a little cardboard box, and takes it and throws it on the bureau in his apartment in New York.
So you write about what happens inside that little cardboard box. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Okay, I can just read that paragraph.
Sure.
One day, several weeks later, he noticed on the bureau a movement so slight it might have been imaginary. He bent down and peered more closely at the box. Tiny spiderlings, so small they were barely visible, were climbing up through the air holes he had punched in the lid. Delighted with this renewal of life so many weeks after the mother's apparent death, Andy stood at the bureau and watched the latest generation of spiders. Even newly hatched, they seemed as busy as a Lilliputian construction crew. Bustling across his daily artifacts, they strung almost invisible web lines from nail scissors to hairbrush, from mirror to comb. Deciding that barn spiders were unlikely to be dangerous to people, Andy let the hundreds of spiderlings cavort across the bureau for the next week or two. Some had departed by the time that he reluctantly evicted the rest because the maid who came in to clean refused to work around a spider refugee camp. After the spiders left the bureau, they continued to scurry around in Andy's imagination.
Oh, this is so fascinating to me because this is essentially, I mean, this is how Charlotte's Web ends, the actual book. I mean, Charlotte's little babies, Wilbur watches them fly off into the breeze.
Yes, it's wonderful. It was really a fascinating project for me. There must have been 12 times when the hair stood up on the back of my nerdy little neck as I got into this wonderful story and found these bits and pieces scattered through his papers and his published letters and essays, a little piece here, a little piece there, and would find all these wonderful details. And it's like Philip Roth or Muriel Spark or somebody writing a book about characters she knows in everyday life.
Mm-hmm.
He did the same thing. We just don't think of that because it's a fantasy.
Well, Michael, I mean, you write about E.B. White's relationship with nature. And what I loved about it is that you talk about how from an early age, E.B. White struggles with anxiety, but he finds peace from that anxiety during summers with his family, taking vacations in Maine, even writing to a friend saying it's one of the most beautiful states in the Union. So can you tell us a little bit more about E.B. White's connection with Maine, since we think of him so much as a New York fixture?
Ah, sure. I think that's one of the most beautiful parts of the story for me is the way that, as a child, he discovered domestic animals, really, in the stable in Mount Vernon, New York. And then he developed just a passionate love of nature outdoors because his family went for the entire month of August every summer, went to the Belgrade Lakes region in Maine. And he writes beautifully about that in such essays as Once More to the Lake. And that kind of excitement and peaceful response to the world helped shape his whole life. He was a shy and timid child. As he said, he was never abused, but he was always anxious. So nature allowed him to totally disappear into the world as himself and not feel, I think, judged in any way. And then when he moved to the coast of Maine as an adult, he bought a 200-year-old farm, and they wound up in the barn there discovering and reconnecting with these simmering, beautiful, potent memories from childhood.
Well, and you write about this in the book where you say that E.B. White or Andy was, you know, really he became too experienced of a farmer to allow his, you know, quote, pastoral ode to get by on merely golden nostalgia, as you say.
Yes, and that becomes a very important thing, maybe the earliest inspiration for Charlotte's Web, emotionally at least, is he begins to have major doubts about the role of the farmer, the morality of farming, that every spring he would be tenderly nursing a piglet only to feed it conscientiously every day and then suddenly in September go, surprise, I'm going to kill you. And he naturally felt that was rather hypocritical. And he tried to save a pig that became very sick, and he knew how weird it was that he was working really hard to save this pig's life. And it died, and he said his sympathy was not about food in the future. It was about the pig was a suffering creature in a suffering world.
Which makes me wonder how children in the time that Charlotte's Web was first published, how they responded. I mean, you write about how E.B. White received just tons of letters from children and adults, for that matter. I mean, particularly the students of Mrs. Bard's fifth grade class at Larchmont, New York. They asked if White really lived on a farm, and he actually responds in detail. You write about that in the book. Can you share what you discovered?
It's a beautiful story that the publisher, Harper, asked him if he would write a public letter that could be sent out to students and other readers. So he told about how he began to feel guilty about his relationship with pigs and that it made him feel treacherous. And then he said, I do not like to betray a person or a creature. And I tend to agree with Mr. E.M. Forster that in these times, it is the duty of a man, above all else, to be reliable. He never would talk down. I mean, bring him E.M. Forster as an illusion while talking to children.
Exactly. Well, speaking of which, perhaps like many, many people, my first exposure to E.B. White as a writer was through his children's stories, through Charlotte's Web and through Stuart Little, in fact. Imagine my shock later on as I grew up and I discovered actually he was a writer for grown-ups more than anything.
Yes.
So what made him write Stuart Little, his first book for children?
I think it said something about the different channels going on in his brain. And it's very interesting to watch his evolution as a writer and as a person, because he was there in the very Genesis myth years of The New Yorker, very important in forming their voice, urbane, witty, sophisticated. And then he married Catherine Angel, and he began to have a different kind of community. She became his community. He moved to Maine. The animals became his community. And I think the stories got deeper and deeper for that reason. And so Stuart Little came to him in a dream, literally, a direct shipment from his subconscious. It's like, will you sign for this? It's your first book. Trust us. And he dreamed, while riding a train in 1926, he dreamed of a little mouse figure or mouse-like figure that even had a hat and spats and a tiny cane. But he gradually worked in so many little details from his own life. And when they said, well, we've got Mickey Mouse now and all these things. Are you sure you want him to be a mouse? And he said, he came in a dream. He arrived that way. That's how he is. I can't change it.
Well, Michael Sims, you reveal so much about the life of E.B. White that I just had no idea about in your book, particularly what happened at the end of his life. E.B. White passed away in 1985. His wife, Catherine, had died before him. But when E.B. White was nearing the end of his life, he was suffering from Alzheimer's. Is that correct?
Yes, yes. For just about a year or so, right before he died.
So not too long, but during that time, his son, Joe, was managing his care and looking after him. And this is what just, I don't know, it just makes my heart stop, because you write that Joe found that reading aloud soothed his father, soothed E.B. White. So he started by reading E.B. White's own work to him. What did White say about that?
Joe White would later tell this story, and Roger Angel has recounted it elsewhere too, that after a while, E.B. White would listen. He would motion yes or no to reading something. If he were more peaceful and able to concentrate longer, White would listen through to the end, and then he would stir and look at Joe and ask him who wrote what had just been read to him. And which is an enormously poignant thing to think that you've lost the memory of all your own work. And Joe would look at him and say, "You did, Dad." And E.B. White would think about this for a moment and sort of turn it around in his mind. And finally, sometimes he would murmur, "Not bad."
Oh. Did Joe read Charlotte's Web to E.B. White?
I do not know. I do not know. Joe himself died a few years ago. Mm. I don't know. That would be a wonderful point, but I was unable to find either way.
Because you can imagine if he had that, you know, the idea that hearing in even some sort of gentle way these echoes of the memory of his childhood as written in Charlotte's Web, how that might have reached E.B. White in his final months suffering with Alzheimer's. But
yes, that it's the kind of a story that, although it was so difficult to write and he went through so many drafts and all that, it's distilled down to the level that you feel that it's not only the first story that many people remember, but that it's the kind of story that you would be able to understand until life's subtractions took the last bit of your understanding away. For example, if you had Alzheimer's, that it might be one of the last stories you could still comprehend.
Hmm. Michael Sims, thank you so much for telling us this story and actually rekindling my love, at least, for just a true American classic. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. It was my pleasure to be here.
Michael Sims' new book is The Story of Charlotte's Web, E.B. White's Eccentric Life in Nature and the Birth of an American Classic. Find an excerpt at our website, radioboston.org.